If you have a green thumb or have always wanted one, then get ready for Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, along with George Allman. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas, help solve problems, and keep you up to date on the latest developments in the nursery and landscaping industry. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. We're going to be here for the next hour talking to you about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Ken. How are you?
I am doing well. I'm doing well. I saw a little while ago that we are in a low rainfall period in California where we have not been getting much rain. Some of the growers around the county, especially the grape growers, are starting to get concerned. I don't know that I would be, I'm not ready to give up on it yet, because I know there's been multiple years where March just goes crazy, or even later in January,
right.
Things can get wet. So,
I think some of that might be just in anticipation of fear. You know, they're getting concerned that we're not going to get enough rain to have a good crop next year, but that would be rain. And there's still, I think our reservoirs are quite full.
I think what it said was they were going to have to irrigate more than they normally
would. But so it goes to that the reservoirs are full.
So yeah. I'm not quite sure what the fear was there, but
you know, a couple of shows ago, John Clements was talking about the periodicity of our rain and how we go through these cycles where, mm-hmm. you know, 5-6, and you've mentioned it in the past as well. You know, we go through a couple of years, 4 years, 5 years with no rain, and then we fill up everything. And that's been the nature of California for decades.
Yeah. And, you know, when I was doing some research for the show today, I found a little brief thing. It says, throughout recent recorded history, California has experienced periodic drought such as 1841, 1864, 1895, 1924, 1928 to 1935, 1947 to 1950, 59 to 61, 76, 77, 86 to 92, 2007 to 2009, 2011 to 2017, and 2020 to 2022.
And then last year we had some good rain.
And we had some good
rain.
And
the year before that, yeah.
It just seems, I mean, looking at the data, it seems cyclical.
Correct.
We are never in a constant prolonged drought for
an
abnormal amount of time from what it would seem. But you and I were discussing before we came on the air, one of the ways that you counter that is you store it.
And that was one of our discussions recently about the infrastructure, right? So when we do get those very rainy seasons, 2-3 years in a row or 1 year, if we're able to capture that more readily and have it available for the dry years, then we wouldn't have the fear that is constantly pushed to us.
It would relieve some of the worry.
The stress.
That's correct. Yeah. Right. Well, Lake Hodges is a prime example. Way below capacity. Because the dam needs to be replaced.
Correct. That's infrastructure, right?
Yeah, that's an infrastructure problem. I did hear on the radio the other day that in some areas where they don't have a lot of precipitation, but they have there's a fair amount of moisture in the air, a fair amount of humidity and fog that they're creating. And I saw this years ago. They were doing this over in some parts of Africa, where they set up these large fine screens perpendicular to the prevailing wind. And as the fog blows through the screen, it condenses on the screen and it trickles down.
I've seen that in South America when I was down in a small town called Antofagasta, which is basically pure desert. And I didn't see any plants that didn't have irrigation on them in the city, but they had that up in the mountains in the Atacama Desert. That's how they were catching moisture.
And you know, you see it happen in your house. If you leave a window open and on a humid, foggy day, you'll get condensation on your screens.
So
it seems pretty simple. I mean, there's no power required for it or anything.
Just materials to gather it and store it, right?
Yeah.
So why do we talk about rain so much? Well, because we're gardeners.
Yeah.
And our plants need that water.
And it really is the best kind of water that you can put on, that your plants can get. You know, it's not subject to any of the chemicals that are put in during treatment
or the
hard water that comes out of a well. So rainwater is outstanding.
Yeah, we've touched on that too, not to keep going back on things we've touched on, but you know, we are at the end of the Colorado River, so we do get a lot of heavily salted waters, mm-hmm. as everything evaporates and it builds into what we end up with. And so our plants suffer for that. You'll mm-hmm. see it with, you know, our avocados, if you're using household irrigation water, you know, plumbed from the street, mm-hmm. As opposed to rain or water that has been reverse osmosis.
Mm-hmm. I remember as a kid at my grandparents' house in Bay Park, my grandmother had a big, she must have brought it from the farm back in Nebraska, but she had a big crock on a stand outside the back door of the laundry room that was exposed to the weather. And it had looked like a bird bath top on it. It was glazed, some very slight depression towards the center. And in the center was a small hole, maybe a quarter of an inch in diameter. And she would use that to catch rainwater. So whenever it would rain, she had rainwater available. And I think my mom told me that she used to wash her hair with rainwater. And there was always water in that.
That's interesting. I mean, because in our Mediterranean climate, when it is so dry during the summers, you know,
yeah.
I can't imagine it having water still.
She must have used it pretty frugally,
right,
throughout the year. But I don't ever remember it being dry as a kid. And it had a little, just the typical little push button tap on it at the base. So,
well, we use a lot of rainwater. Well, not a lot, obviously, because we haven't had any in a while. But whenever it does rain, we have some trash cans that are set beside the house, or the garage, rather. They're unsightly. They shouldn't be there, but that's because I'm lazy. And they tend to get water off the roof. And that's what we use on all of our house plants, the porch plants. And they thrive, I think, with that water.
Oh,
better than any irrigation
water. They love it. You know, one thing that's interesting about your storage system that you talk about is the regulations that there are in water storage systems. You would think that in a drought area, any kind of capture and reuse of rainwater would be applauded, but that's not necessarily the case with the regulatory agencies. And I thought I had read somewhere within the city of San Diego that you're not supposed to use 33 gallon trash cans to catch water. And I don't understand what the reasoning would be, unless the plastic that's used in a trash can is not necessarily good for storing water for human consumption, but that doesn't.
Well, that would make sense from a human consumption standpoint, yeah. Or for pets, or for wild, or for farm stock.
Yeah, but if you're not using plants, it for that, then I don't.
I find that interesting. Yeah. I've not read that, so that'd be. I'm curious.
I would have to do some research, but I thought I had read that. I thought I had read that somewhere. You know, the other thing that goes along, kind of hand in hand with the storage thing is, as expensive as water is in San Diego, compared to a storage system that's going to make a significant impact on your
water bill
it's disproportionate.
It would take a lot of storage capacity in your yard, especially if you have a smaller home or lot. It would be very difficult to recoup any of the money. Now, you would get good water.
Oh, yes.
And it would work well, but it's difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when I think the city of San Diego at the highest tier now, water is somewhere around $13 a unit is 724 gallons of water.
I thought it was 748, but I'll buy that. Okay.
If it was 700,
yes,
that's a lot of water to store.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So you're spending a large amount of money for a fraction of what you could buy it for.
I think we had I still have at my other house rain storage tanks, and I think we were able to store about 1,100 gallons.
That's a decent amount.
It is, but as soon as it may, in the heat of the summer, may keep you from one tier, mm-hmm. going up one, which isn't that much.
Yeah.
And the problem with having rain storage is you get to store during the winter months, when you don't need it.
Well, yeah.
Right? Because it's going to rain tomorrow, and now you have these full tanks that are just overflowing. And then as we move further into the summer, you use it up in a week or 2 weeks, depending on the quantity that you are storing.
It is kind of interesting looking at my water bill and adjusting for the small amounts of rain that we, adjusting my sprinkler system and irrigation system for the small amount of rain that we do get. But in the winter, and the cooler weather helps too, the evaporation is not as high. But my water bill dropped by over 50% during the cooler months.
Oh, easily.
Yeah.
And we, and I think I've mentioned this to you before, we tend to turn, our water's all off right now. We don't, even though we haven't had any rain, just because it's been cooler days, except for, you know, recently.
Well, and you mulch too.
We mulch a lot, but I also tend to water when I feel that the plants need it. And I'll go out and turn on that particular zone.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to them going off just because it's Thursday and it's supposed to go off.
Yeah. You know,
we could have had 4 days of fog and coolness and they would still go off. And I would rather that not happen.
Yeah. If you've got the wherewithal to do it, even though you're running it through a clock and an electronic controller, you're still doing it manually.
I am doing it manually. Right. Yeah. They're not going off because it's Thursday at 5 a.m.
Yeah.
They're going off because I think they need to be on and I'll turn that zone on.
Yeah.
Right.
And like I said, if you have the wherewithal and the time to do it, that's probably not a bad way to do it. So
I can sometimes, you know, add an extra 2 or 3 days between waterings by doing it that way.
Oh, I would think so.
Yeah, maybe more. Just depends on the weather.
I would think so. I know we have quite a few potted plants around the backyard, and all of that gets hand watered, and sometimes it goes sometimes to its own detriment, but it is all.
Well, that is one of the negatives of doing it manually.
That is true. Yeah. That is true. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Ullman. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Ullman.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Ullman. We were talking about water and irrigation and rain here in Southern California. And I happened to look the other day at the water level at Lake Mead, which is still very low. As a matter of fact, there's a very interesting YouTube channel called Sidetrack Adventures, and it's filmed by a guy who lives here in San Diego, but he goes out to different interesting places around Southern California, Nevada, Arizona. And he went to a town that was, I can't remember the name of it now, but he went to a town in Nevada that was a ghost town that had been flooded by Lake Mead, and at one point was 72 feet underwater. And now it's completely dry and you can go and wander around. Bureau of Reclamation has put up historic markers and pictures of what used to be there. But that was pretty interesting. But looking at the current water level at Lake Mead, we're about 4 feet below where we were in 2023. We're 20 feet above where we were in 2022. That's a lot of water.
That is a lot.
It's an insane amount of water.
And when I was saying earlier about that our reservoirs are full, they were filling. And some of our Northern California are full. They were overflowing during the rains last year.
Yeah. And it seems like we got snow early in the Sierra this year. I know Mammoth was open mid-November, I think. And I think there's snow up in Tahoe right now. So hopefully we'll... And that's where most of the water comes from.
Right. Oh, yeah. It's snowpack.
Is the snowpack. We do have garden classes today. We have fruit trees with Tyler Trimble in San Diego at 9 o'clock. Always a popular class. Tyler is absolutely brilliant when it comes to fruit trees. So if you'd like to stop in and get some fruit tree information, he would be a very good one to listen to. And in Poway at 9:30, it's going to be spring rose care and planting with James. Also another very informative class. And that'll get you started on your rose garden.
On your rose garden and your fruit trees for the new year.
And your fruit trees for the new year. And And we have a question from Kevin at the studio. Are you there? Are you with us, Kevin?
Yes, I am. Yes, okay. I am. So I was at the mall at a University Town Center. Kudos to them. They do a great job with their landscaping, by the way.
Yes, they do.
And they must have installed. They must have planted about 10,000 of these little beautiful little flowering plants. And I used my Google Lens to figure out what they were. And apparently they're called cyclamen. That's how much of a gardening buff I am. They're called cyclamen, and they're beautiful. They have like super shiny waxy leaves, and the flowers look almost like little tulips, kind of.
Yeah, like an upside down tulip.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, do they grow all winter long, and can I buy them, and can I swing by on my way home and get some?
Yeah, they're typically available during the cooler season. It actually grows from a bulb. They do have the foliage is almost as pretty as the flowers on them. It's a really unique plant, and they will grow during the cooler season. They are typically available during that time. There's the regular standard sized ones, which can be pretty big. And then we also get smaller miniature ones, which we sell in 4-inch pots where the flowers are maybe maybe a third of the size of regular cyclamen.
Yep. Right.
These were about 5 inches tall.
Yeah, that sounds like a standard one. The dwarf ones are going to be about half that size.
Oh, okay. All right.
When they're available. But yeah, they're pretty regularly available.
Oh, okay, cool.
As the weather starts to warm up, they will go dormant. But as long as they don't sit in an area that stays really wet, you can leave the bulbs in the ground. Or if it's an area where you think it might be too moist, go ahead and dig those bulbs up, knock the dirt off of them, and store them in a cool, dry place. Until next year, and you can plant them in the fall, and they will come right back again.
Ah, very cool, because I want to put them around the bird bath at my mom's place so she doesn't look out and see just dead lawn and stuff. But I like to call it food for the gophers is what I like to think of it as. Whatever I plant there, apparently the gophers eat it.
I've never heard of it being a problem as far as gophers are concerned.
No, wow. But again, it won't take full sun.
Yeah, they don't take full sun.
So you don't want to put it in full sun. And you can impress your friends by calling it sow bread or swine bread. Those are two common names for it.
I'm going to go with swine bread, clearly.
Clearly.
Clearly, we're going with swine bread. Wow. Which sounds like something off menu at a restaurant somewhere. Yes, and I'll have a side of the swine bread.
It's a medieval restaurant, yes.
All right, thank you, guys. You're the best.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it. Take care. Bye. If you have a question for us or a suggestion for the show, something you want us to talk about, go ahead and drop us an email at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. And remember, Anderson is spelled S-E-N, not S-O-N. We would be more than happy to take a look at it and talk about it on an upcoming show.
You know, it's funny. I was looking up cyclamens the other day because I was talking to somebody about them. And one of the things I had learned was that just like roses, they've gotten so into new colors and size of petals, et cetera, that they've kind of bred out the fragrance.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the cyclamens were like that. Mm-hmm. And with all the breeding to make new cyclamen colors and leaf variegations and stuff, that they've kind of bred out some of the fragrance of the more fragrant florist type.
Yeah, that's true. And typically now the ones that you see that are fragrant are going to be the smaller ones. The dwarf varieties. Right. And some of those are incredibly fragrant. It's really just kind of a hit or miss. And the best way to find out is pick it up and smell it.
Well, that would make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. But the small ones typically are very fragrant. The big ones, not so much. But I know we'd mentioned it on the show before, but there used to be a grower up in Encinitas. Where they were is now a giant self-storage facility on the east side of 5. I think it was off of Santa Fe, but it was, the name of the place was Tuttle Farms, and that's what they grew was cyclamen. And we would send our trucks up there, and we would load an entire truck full of 6-inch cyclamen, and he grew all of his cyclamen in clay, in terracotta clay pots. And they were always completely covered with green moss they were horrible to handle because they were slippery. They would be
maybe horrible to handle, but that's actually a nice patina and that's quite pretty.
It's quite popular. Yeah. You know, I look back on it now, we probably could have bought the cyclamen thrown the cyclamen away and sold the pots for a premium. That was before we had stick-on labels and things like that, and they were hard to price because you couldn't write on the container because there was so much moss on it. But I remember going up, and we would just buy hundreds of them at a time. And the entrance to our San Diego store, the parking lot and the main entrance used to be on Enterprise Street around the corner from where it is now. And that main walkway up to the front of the store, we would just completely cover that with cyclamen, and we sold them by the thousands. Still a popular plant, but nobody grows them like they did, or at least in the quantities that they did. But there are some growers out there that still do a good job of it.
They are still very popular. We do get just this time of the year, we have a number of folks that come in regularly to purchase them, and we get people that call. I think a lot of people don't realize that they will come back, and so they when they die off in the or go dormant in the summer or warmer months, they just discard it, or you know, that's it. And they purchase new ones next year.
Yeah. There's a few plants like that, right. They may be perennial, but it's easier just to
get a new one,
get a new one down the road.
Well, speaking of fragrant, I have in my hand a little leaf that I'm going to hand you. I'm going to crush it so that you can smell it. So smell that.
That looks like an allspice leaf.
Well, look at you knowing your plants.
Oh yeah.
Doesn't that smell nice?
Yeah, that is.
So I was watering this morning and I remembered that a coworker here, Gretchen, had asked me for some allspice leaves. So I brought some in for her. It's a beautiful plant.
It is.
It is a gorgeous plant. We have one growing in a shade section near our olive trees in a large pot. It's tropical-ish. It needs a lot more water. It doesn't do well in the full sun, at least where we are in Poway. But it's a great plant and it's very fragrant.
Yeah. The smell of it is really pretty amazing. We've had them from time to time, but it's rare that nobody grows it on a regular basis, and it's kind of rare to find it.
It is a, typically the leaves are not used in any kind of cooking. They use them for essential oils. They'll use them to get oil out. But typically it's the berries.
The
dried berries. Mm-hmm. And I have not yet, I've had this plant for 4 or 5 years and I've not had it flower yet. So I'm hoping one of these days I will get something out of it.
Now with allspice, I believe it's the, is it the husk of the berry that is the source for the spice mace?
No, that comes from the same, that clove, I mean, that, you could say it out loud. Nutmeg.
Oh, nutmeg. Yeah. Okay.
It's the same plant that comes out, not from allspice.
I know it was one of those two. Yeah,
but what I was going to say was the flowers, male and female flowers come from different plants, so I may never get the berries. I may get flowers,
but I may not get berries
if I don't get any pollination. But that's a great plant.
You know, another great plant, which actually does really well in our low water environment, is bay leaves.
Well, you didn't say another fragrant leaf.
It's another fragrant leaf / spice that grows very well in our Mediterranean climate is bay leaves.
Very much so.
And we have one in our backyard that's, I'm going to say 10 feet tall. And Melanie's out there all the time. She never uses dry bay leaves. She always uses fresh bay leaves. And you just walk out, grab a handful of them and bring them in. And
I typically do the same thing just because we do have some in a jar that whenever we prune, I'll bring some in and put them in a jar or let them dry first, then put them in the jar. But typically we will, I'll just pick them off the tree and use them. We have three of them. They do flower. They have pretty little flowers.
I don't know that I've ever noticed the flower on it.
Mine, I have one that tends to get scale regularly.
Yeah, they will.
It gets scale. It looks pretty raunchy.
Yeah, you want to make sure you clean that off before you throw it in your soup.
If you are allergic to shellfish, if you would get some kind of reaction from eating scale.
I don't know.
That's an interesting.
I don't know anybody that's allergic to shellfish to ask them if they want to try it.
We don't want to try that. But anyway, so that's a good plant to grow. It's very drought tolerant, as you had mentioned. It's pretty, and you can get a small, if you don't have room, because they can get big. They are slow growers. They get quite large. But there is a small variety that Monrovia grows called Little Ragu.
Yeah.
And it's a dwarf variety with the same flavor characteristics as the regular one.
Yeah. You can grow it in a small container.
Right.
Another interesting note about bay laurel is in Greek and Roman culture, when you see individuals with the
crown
with a crown of laurel, that's what it is.
That is, yes.
That is what it is. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more Garden Talk right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. We were going into the break. We were talking about fragrant foliage, culinary foliage mentioned. You mentioned the allspice, that you, the tropical allspice that you have, which is an outstanding plant when you can find it around here, unfortunately. And bay leaf, which is available all the time. And it's evergreen, does very well in this Mediterranean climate. Another one that does really well and comes in quite a few different varieties. Well, when I first started in this, there was one rosemary. That was it. It was just an upright rose. It was Rosemary officinalis.
Right.
Now there's different cultivars of upright rosemary. There's different cultivars of trailing rosemary. You can use it as a ground cover. You can use it as a hedge. You can use it as just a drought tolerant shrub in your yard. We have one in our backyard that's probably, I'd say it's a little over 3 feet tall and probably about 6 feet in diameter. And we keep it. That's where we keep it trained to. I actually need to make it smaller. It's encroaching on a walkway. But when Melanie's cooking in the, and she needs rosemary, she just walks out and grabs a
oh, yeah.
couple of sprigs off of it. The tender sprigs at the tips of the branches are incredible.
Delicious in potatoes and pork. Oh, and chicken.
And
well, everything.
And some
everything.
Cocktails.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that I didn't know.
Yeah.
But you know, up until 2017, what was the name you just called it?
Rosemarinus officinalis.
Right. And that changed in 2017. It became a salvia.
Oh, did it? That's yes. right.
So
I forgot
remember
that.
We've
that.
Talked
that,
about that. It's a salvia.
I forgot
now,
about that.
The same family.
Yeah.
And I mean, same genus.
Yeah.
Right.
And,
and the flowers look very much
it like
it.
Look
I,
like
it
a
didn't
salvia.
Surprise me at all when it changed because the flowers do look very salvia.
And typically when they're classifying plants, it's usually done
because
by
of the flower
characteristics.
Very drought tolerant, as you mentioned. It will bloom more readily with a little extra water, and bees love it. And so it's a great plant if you're trying to promote bees in your yard.
Yeah. Ours doesn't bloom that much, but it does put off a lot of new tender growth. And that's really the best part to use is the growing tips. It grows in incredibly bad soil too. So if you like our backyard. I mean, it is perfectly happy in our backyard in the terrible soil that we have. Once you get it, I would treat it like a native, plant it in the cooler months, let it get established. And once it's established, you really don't have to water it much.
I agree. Yeah. It can take considerable drought, but again, it will look better and flower more with a little water. Good looking plant. I think the only pest I've seen on it with any degree is spittle bug.
You got it.
It gets spittle bug quite a bit.
That's the only thing I've ever seen on it is spittle bug. And as gross as spittle bug is, it's easy to control.
Strong jet stream of water.
Jet stream of water will take care of it every time. You don't have to put any pesticides on it or anything like that. You know, it's funny. There's not a lot of stuff that I've seen spittle bug on. Rosemary is one. It's pretty common on that. But I remember as a kid, we had a strawberry guava tree in our backyard in Bay Park, and it was tall. I wasn't, so it may not have been that big.
Everything's tall to me.
Yeah. But I remember one time it got spittle bug so bad that if you stood underneath of it, it was like rain.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh my God. That sounds kind of gross. Actually.
I was a kid. I didn't know the difference, but
so you said you typically don't see spittle bug on other plants other than salvia. You just mentioned one, but salvia, I mean, on the rosemary. But I've seen it on other salvias.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like hot lips, some of the gray eyes. I've seen some spittle bug. But that brings us to another flavorful and aromatic leaf.
Yeah, salvias.
Salvias.
There's a
regular
lot of them
salvias,
out there.
Yeah, not the rosemary.
There's a lot of them out there.
I think in the West here, we have about 100 different species of salvia. Obviously, not all of them are edible, but there is the culinary salvia. the sages that you can cook with.
Yeah, I know in the springtime we typically have 3 or 4 different varieties of culinary sage.
I really like the I forgot the name of it, like a triple colored one. It's got yellow and kind of purple.
Yellow, purple, and green. Yeah, the gorgeous, variegated one.
That's a gorgeous one.
It is very pretty. A lot of the native salvias are incredibly fragrant too.
You brush against them and you know that you touched the salvia, right?
White salvia, especially, which is it's an interesting looking plant. I mean,
that's Salvia apiana.
Apiana, yeah.
And it is interesting, but when you touch that one, I feel like there's oil all over my hand that I have to wash off. It's a sticky oil as opposed to the others that you kind of touch and you can smell the fragrance, but it doesn't feel like it's staying with you.
Yeah, it's not stuck to you.
Right.
The Salvia apiana, the native white sage, if you're having problems with ghosts or spirits in your house, that's the one that you want to use to smudge your house with.
That's what they use in smudge pots, right?
You clump it together kind of like a really bad looking cigar, and after it dries and you can light it like almost like incense, and you can, and the supposedly the smoke from the smoke from it will help force the bad spirits out of your abode.
One though breaks incredibly easily, that plant. If you brush up against a large stalk, it falls. It's kind of like a jade plant. You know, if you hit a jade, all the leaves fall off. I've had that with the salvia, the white sage. They break easily.
Yeah. You know, one that reminds me too, remember when we used to go, camping up in the mountains, not in the high mountains, but where Cleveland sage grows, which is the native in this area, hence the Cleveland forest, but Salvia clevelandii, where when you're in areas where that grows, where it's predominant, if you're out there and it rains, you can smell it. The rain falling on the foliage releases the fragrance, and it's just wonderful.
There is what I call a canyon smell here. If you hike through the canyons and you stray a little bit from the trails where you brush up against a lot of the native salvias, you'll have that aroma on you when you get home.
Yeah. The other aroma like that I remember from going up and camping in the Sierra is that when it rains and you're in pine trees or conifers,
that's heavenly.
That conifer smell is just amazing. And before they took before they took most of it out at the Safari Park, they had a conifer forest.
That's right, in the back where Australia is now, the Australian Walkabout.
Yeah, but that you could walk through there, and it just smelled. Right. You would swear you were up in the mountains or an alpine area.
Where I grew up in New York, we had some pine barrens like that, and there were wild blueberries growing around it. It was wonderful to walk through. That's a great memory. I'm going to get that scent. I'm going to go home and look for some pine scent. And
there's a big section of southern New Jersey that is pine barrens as well.
Yep.
Supposedly that's where the Jersey Devil lives, is in a pine barren in the southern part. You know, speaking of pines, I saw something a couple of years ago. They were talking about the pine needle mulch industry back in on the eastern seaboard, mostly in the Carolinas, where they go through and they just go and get pine needles and pack it as mulch. It's a multi-billion dollar industry back there.
And you can buy for children, you can purchase little kits with larger pine needles for making baskets and such. And they have the instructions and you can get things like that. I think I got it here probably 20 years ago. 25. We've been here since 98, I think, at this location.
Yeah.
I purchased a pine tree right around there, and I had to cut it down about 2 years ago because it had gotten too big in the backyard. It wasn't too big. Let me take that back. It was leaning. Mm-hmm. It wasn't too big because it's a perfect spot. But underneath it, I constantly had enough pine mulch to mulch plants everywhere and give away to people that wanted it. It was constantly coming down from a single. I can't remember now if that one was my Aleppo or my stone, Italian stone, but I did make pesto out of it once. I took the pine cones, separated the seeds, and made pesto with that and basil from the garden.
Yeah, I know if you go up to Torrey Pines, there's a lot of pine needles under the Torrey Pines shed. They have those really long the really long, thick needles on them. There was something else I was thinking about, pines now. It's escaped my...
Well, I will tell you that making pesto or getting pine nuts by yourself with a little, you know, hand piece one by one is a tedious task, and that your hands are very sticky and tar-like when you are done.
I have heard it is very sticky.
Very sticky resin work. Yeah.
Well, and you know, another interesting thing that they get from pines back east, pine tar. And
which they use for ships.
And I know if you're not familiar with what it smells like, I can tell you, if you want to find out what it smells like, take a trip down to the Maritime Museum, go on board Star of India, go down to the second deck, walk all the way forward to the bosun locker. That's what pine tar smells like. It just permeates the air, and it's used all over the ship for
especially on pitcher's mounds, right?
That's what's on baseball bats. That was a big product in North Carolina, hence the North Carolina, the UNC team is the Tar Heels. So, and I actually have one grandkid who's a Tar Heel and one who was born at Duke. So,
see, now I would have thought that I didn't know that, by the way, but I thought the Tar Heels were from tar, like asphalt tar, like the La Brea tar pits, and not from a baseball bat or from the resin of a pine tree.
I believe it's from the pine. Huh. I believe it's from
now
from
I have to look trees. That up.
I would have to look that up and confirm it too, but I thought I had read somewhere that that's okay. what it was.
Well, so. I'll take you on your word till I can prove
until you can
until
prove
I
me
prove
wrong.
You otherwise. Yeah. Yes.
There was an interesting article that just recently came out. One of the websites that we follow as far as monarchs are concerned.
And if you've listened to this show for any length of time, you'll know that Ken brings this particular website up because they have a lot of useful information.
They have a lot of useful information, and they have a lot of it. It's good information. I mean, it's not somebody's opinion. It's not opinion, and it's not one-sided. They look very closely at the whole thing, but the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did rule that monarchs are going to be listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. But we had just read and we had just talked about an article from that same website
a couple weeks ago,
where it's not the butterflies that are threatened. It's their migration is being
their migratory
their
paths.
Migratory path.
Right.
They don't migrate as much. So the entomologists that they had been talking to saying it's an indication of them adapting. So why migrate?
So they're not migrating as far because they don't have to.
They don't have to.
Right.
Yeah. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll talk about this a little bit more when we come back. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman, and we were talking about
We were talking about tar.
And
but I do stand corrected.
Producer Kevin
I looked it up as well, and I stand corrected. You are correct. It was from the tar in the trees, or the pitch in the trees, and the resin.
One of the other byproducts of that, which I didn't realize as a kid, was turpentine.
That part I knew, oddly.
I didn't know that as a kid, but you know, you don't see turpentine very much anymore.
No, but by 1861, North Carolina had over 1600 turpentine distilleries, and 2/3 of all turpentine in the United States came from North Carolina.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I'll have to tell my daughter that, see if she, you know what? I may have to go in search of some of that stuff the next time I go back to visit her, see if there's
turpentine
or just the historical aspects.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Of pine tar.
Yep.
I'll have to go check that out. So anyway, before the break, we were talking about the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service listing monarch butterflies as threatened, and there's a number of issues that brings up. And one of the things that they mentioned is monarch butterfly fans anticipate months of havoc as its threatened status is clarified. In particular, people who raise, release, and handle monarch butterflies and milkweed will have many questions as the public comment period unfolds over the coming months. That discussion will determine the 4D rules, ESA parlance for Endangered Species Act parlance for specific directives that will explain exactly what will and will not be allowed. So it's gonna change things. Will we still be able to tag monarch butterflies and participate in citizen science? Will cutting back or removing milkweed be against the law? Will festivals, museums, and weddings and funerals still be able to feature monarch butterflies and tagging demonstrations, educational exhibits, and symbolic and inspirational releases that capture their magic? So it's not just a label.
There are implications associated with it.
There are implications that go with it.
I was unaware of that. Yeah,
I was too until I was reading this article.
I thought part of our discussion several weeks ago, maybe a month ago, was about the monarch and the migratory patterns that they're staying, kind of like staycations, because so many more people and gardens, whether they're public or private, that plant milkweeds and plants to attract monarchs. They're bringing them in, and so they're less likely to make that long journey somewhere else when they have everything kind of in their own backyard, so to speak.
Yeah, hence like we were saying, why go on this thousands of miles
journey
in migration when you don't have to?
Right.
So they
that stemmed from a previous article and that
the same website.
Yeah. And what was that website again for everybody?
Texas Butterfly Ranch. It's Texas Butterfly Ranch, and I can't remember if it's .com or .org.
We'll put that on the Walter Anderson main Facebook page
today. So check that out. It also says that monarch conservation nonprofits were quick to pounce on the fundraising opportunities presented by the decision to list the monarch. Within hours of the announcement, Monarch Joint Venture sent out emails announcing the news along with a plea for donations. This proposed listing is more than a warning. It's a call to action. Monarchs are running out of time, and your support can make a difference. Monarchs need more than hope. They need you. Will you answer the call and donate now? I find that somewhat... It's a tough situation. You know, if they list them as threatened, whereas other scientists are saying that no, it's just their migration pattern that's threatened. The actual insect itself is not. There's a whole lot of baggage that goes with this, rather than just listing them as endangered.
Right.
And it seems that there may be some out there that will try to exploit it.
And again, I don't know what the one you just read with the campaign for the nonprofit to gather more funds, you know, what is that going to be used for? To plant more milkweed?
If that's even going to be allowed.
Right.
Or to remove milkweed, if that's even going to be allowed.
It's interesting. We'll have to follow it and see what goes on with it. It's interesting.
It's definitely going to be something that we're going to have to.
Because every milkweed season here, at the nursery, when customers come in, there are mixed feelings from customers that as far as the butterfly goes. Some people want them desperately in their yard, and they'll buy every milkweed we have. Some will only buy the natives. Some are very quick to chastise us for selling tropical milkweed, and so there's a lot of emotion that goes around the monarchs.
There is, and this is interesting too, and it kind of touches on what we were talking about in the previous article. So some scientists believe that monarchs are changing their habits, and many are no longer migrating but building local populations in California, along the Texas coast, South Carolina, and Florida. They are reproducing locally and foregoing the arduous journey of migrating. And why not? If food, shelter, mates, and host plant and a hospitable climate exist in the neighborhood, why undertake the often fatal migration in order to reproduce and continue the life cycle? A study released in October by monarch butterfly scientist and migration studies expert Dr. Andy Davis at the University of Georgia found that the monarch butterfly's breeding population is stable and thriving, while its fall migratory population is in serious decline. That's exactly what we were just talking about.
And what we spoke of previously. So yeah. Agreed. It's a staycation, as I said earlier. Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, no possibility exists for listing a phenomenon such as a migration as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act. Listing species itself may be the only recourse for protection.
So that, to me, that begs the question, do they need protection?
Yeah. And it says, a renowned monarch butterfly scientist, the late Lincoln Brewer, was asked whether or not he believed monarch butterflies were approaching extinction. He evaded the question. Instead, Brewer responded, do you think it's done some good?
I guess, again, we'll follow and see.
We will have to keep track of it and see what's going on. But anyway, check out the Texas Butterfly Ranch. They have a whole list of articles archived there going back a number of years. I find it very interesting, and it seems to be good information. And not necessarily full of emotion or opinion.
Right, so, right.
As some can be.
It can be, as I was alluding earlier with folks that come in.
And I found an interesting article online the other day. 11 facts you didn't know about Napa Valley. Napa produces only 4% of California's wine and a mere 0.4% of the world's wine, yet stands as one of the most renowned wine regions globally. I had no idea that their production was that low.
That surprises me. I've never been up there, but based on just the narrative, when you hear about it, it sounds, I always felt that was the big, massive wine capital of California.
But yeah, I thought that was very interesting. It's a beautiful place. I highly recommend you go up there and check it out.
Capri has been wanting me desperately to go up there, so we'll get up there.
Yeah. Napa Valley's wine industry supports over 50,000 jobs in the county and approximately 200,000 nationwide, contributing more than $34 billion to the U.S. economy. Approximately 95% of Napa Valley wineries are family owned, which that's a pretty good percentage. I know the one that we're members of is a family owned winery and vineyard that dates back over 100 years. And they, if you like Zinfandel, they produce the absolutely best Zinfandel I've ever tasted. It's
Easy. I won't be going there.
Chase Cellars. The valley is about 30 miles long and 5 miles wide at its broadest point, with the Napa River running from north to south through its center. Valley's vineyards span elevations from sea level up to 2,600 feet, offering diverse microclimates that contribute to the unique characteristics of its wines. Napa Valley is home to over 300 stone arch bridges, more than any other county in the United States. I didn't know people were counting stone arch bridges, but it's funny, the few times that I've been up there,
That's not what you remember.
I've never seen one that I was aware of. So I'll have to go up there and look for stone arch bridges. Yeah. Maybe somebody can make a movie, Stone Arch Bridges of Napa Valley.
Maybe you've had too much Zinfandel, and there are lots of bridges, and you just didn't notice them.
Maybe that was it. The devastating phylloxera epidemic between 1989 and 1992 led to the loss of nearly 50,000 acres of Napa Valley grapevines. I didn't realize it was that high. In 1976, during the Judgment of Paris, Napa Valley's 1973 Chateau Montalina Chardonnay and Stag's Leap wine cellars Cabernet Sauvignon surpassed esteemed French wines in a blind tasting. Stag's Leap is an incredible place. They do produce some amazing wine there, and it's a beautiful winery. The region's Mediterranean climate is rare, as only 2% of the Earth's surface shares this climate type, providing ideal conditions for grape cultivation. The region's first commercial winery, Charles Krug Winery, was established in 1861 and continues to operate today. And last but not least, the region's unique terroir includes over 100 different soil variations, more than any other wine region in the world.
That's impressive.
Yeah. Those are all pretty impressive figures. You know, it's interesting. Leland Stanford had a vineyard one time in, I think it was up in Lassen County. It was over 3,000 acres. I think it was 3,600 acres
of grapes.
Of grapes. And that was back before the turn of the last century.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was way back. I think that whole ranch, I can't remember the name of it now, all got donated to Stanford University. Well, that's about it for this week on Garden Talk. Please join us next weekend when Pedro Berry, a local arborist, is going to be here talking about everything you need to know about when you need to hire an arborist and what they actually can do for you. You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anders along with George Allman. We'll be back next week with another hour. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for joining us on Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, your source for gardening, landscaping, and horticultural news. Still have a question for the Garden Talk crew, or want to learn more about the show or how to become a guest or sponsor? Send an email to gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. That's gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com, or visit walteranderson.com. There's more professional gardening advice next week at the same time on Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery.